ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The book about the two brilliant men, one Australian and one New Zealander, gives an idea of their enormous importance. It's called The Basis of Everything by Andrew Ramsey, who says, "It's the story of an Antipodean friendship and a scientific endeavour that changed the world forever." But our own Mark Oliphant was not only smart, he was also decent, kind, an example for today's leaders. And this science show is all about him. Hello again, Robin Williams with a special science show for Easter. Sir Mark Oliphant was our first ever president of the Australian Academy of Science, appointed 70 years ago this month. He made Oppenheimer possible, but wasn't in the film. He helped revolutionise modern physics and the 20th century. So to start, before we hear from the man himself, meet Michael Wilson in Canberra, grandson of the late Sir Mark.
He came back and lots of people have commented that he really put a torpedo through a very promising and well-remunerated research career by coming back to Australia. But he felt that studying science and doing scientific research at a world-class level was an important capability that Australia needed to develop. And he felt in arguing for the establishment of the Australian National University as a principal research university, that that was the best contribution he could make to his nation. And again, contrary to what some say, he never regretted that. He understood what he was giving up. He understood the sacrifice he was making. But until the day he died, in conversations with me, he was proudest of what he did in establishing the research school here at the ANU and his role in establishing the university more generally as a world-class institution.
Let me just quote to reinforce what you just said and illustrate his idealism. He said, "I have a deep confidence in the part which science can play in making us strong and prosperous." He's talking about Australia, of course. "And an idea that the proper use of science within its diverse territories may point the way to a secure and good life for all, for the community." The idealism is so strong.
Indeed, the community and the population of the world. And when you think about some of the scientific discoveries he'd been involved with in particle physics, you know, the team at Cambridge that split the atom, his work later on microwave radar at the University of Birmingham, and his work on putting atomic physics into play to, as they felt at the time, win victory in the Second World War. His view of science and learning was fundamentally connected to his view of the well-being of humanity and the advancement of humanity in all fields.
There's one paradox, though. He, very peaceful man, as you implied, and I read that quotation, idealistic. And yet he was the one who recognised the problem of the bomb and that the Germans might get it. And he famously, although not in the movie, took the letter to America that made the Manhattan Project happen. Was he always happy about having done that, or was he conflicted?
So, yes, you make reference to Oppenheimer, the movie, and if you watch the movie, the story really starts with Ernest Lawrence at Berkeley University in California. And it is true. My grandfather was the one who saw Lawrence as the one who would have the vision, but also the political nous, to sell the idea of developing the atomic bomb to the Americans, which was the only allied power that had the finances and scientific capability to carry it off. It was quite clear to everyone. To answer your question, yes, he was conflicted about it, but what he would always say was, what you need to understand is we were in a real war of survival against an ideology manifest in the Nazi regime and Adolf Hitler in Germany. And while we understood the sort of terror and sort of change to world history that the use of such a weapon would imply, it was so much more important to beat this evil regime. And if they had come out of World War II victorious, we'd all be living different lives.
Yes.
And that's what he liked to remind people. But in terms of his part in bringing on at the immediate destruction that was wrought by the use of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he felt incredibly guilty about that at a human level. And he never balanced, at least in conversations with me, the point of the need to beat Hitler with the humanitarian impact of the bomb. He never tried to justify it that way. The two realities existed in parallel.
Well, of course, we're here to celebrate the formation of the Academy of Science just over 70 years ago. And he was playing such a big part in that move, which they'd tried to establish in 1901, a long time ago. What did Mark manage to do that no one else could seem to bring off?
I think there are several parts to that, but perhaps the most important one, remembering that Mark was one of the youngest fellows of the Royal Society of London that there had ever been, and understood with the colleagues that he mixed with at the height of his postgraduate and research career, that the Royal Society played a fundamental role in connecting people and bringing the importance of scientific research to light and to the public consciousness.
So he saw an example that he wanted to follow.
He saw an example that he wanted to follow, and he didn't think the answer was to nominate Australians to be fellows of the Royal Society in London. He wanted an Australian institution which would herald our excellence and which would provide our home, as this place does, for all of those high-level, world-level discussions and debates. That's why he felt it was important.
Michael Wilson with me in the Shine Dome at the Academy of Science in Canberra. And so to the man himself, Mark Oliphant, and his legendary friend from New Zealand, Lord Rutherford. We go back 40 years to when we last talked real history together, and begin with Sir Mark addressing a graduation ceremony, giving advice that is oh so pertinent today.
In Australia, we have learnt recently that economics is indeed the dismal science. Perhaps it will be one who graduates today, who will recreate it as a source of getting things done, rather than providing reasons for no creative activity. We have the people with skills to do almost anything. We have the materials required for almost any task. What we lack is the will on the part of governments, industries, and individuals to go ahead and do the job. When we dig to produce our own vegetables, or prune our fruit trees, or even build our own garage, we do not feel that we are thereby in debt. Our labour has produced something which did not exist beforehand. But as a nation, we create enormous debts rather than assets. We import rather than make. There is something wrong somewhere in a land which, in general, prefers the creative schools of other nations.
For some reason, that music has always reminded me of Mark Oliphant, the humble man, the powerful intellect, the figure who helped shape the 20th century. Marcus Lawrence Elwin Oliphant died on Bastille Day, the 14th of July.
So Mark was more than a great physicist. He was an extraordinary Australian and someone who made a difference to people's lives all over the world. I remember a small incident in England that was typical. I was at the University of Birmingham in the company of a leading light from the Women's Institute, a pleasant lady of a certain age and clear and obvious intelligence, who'd managed to inspire the National Women's Organization to put aside casseroles and knitting patterns in favor of a really impressive scientific program for her members. What inspired this unheard-of initiative, I asked her. Well, she replied, I was here at the University of Birmingham 50 years ago, and my professor was Dr. Mark Oliphant. He was the inspiration for me to keep up with physics, my lifelong love of science, and the confidence to get our 350,000 membership to do the same. Sir Mark was born on the 8th of October 1901. He lived the 20th century. Today's science show, mostly recorded in the mid-1980s, tracks some of his achievements, starting, of course, in the beginning.
Well, I came from what the Americans would call a do-gooder family and was encouraged very much to attend church regularly, and I became an altar boy. And indeed, my father thought that I was going to become a Church of England clergyman. And so he had me taught Latin and Greek before I went to high school by a friend of his who was very good indeed, so that I've retained most of my Latin and some of my Greek. And I'm very glad that I went through that experience. But that, of course, was before I went to school. At school, I changed my mind and decided I wanted to be a doctor. That was the best way to do good in the world. But the family being not well off, I had to get a job before I could find out some way of going to university. And I worked in the public library for a year. And I worked for a manufacturing jeweller at 10 bob a week. But the attraction of the library was that it gave me time off for one subject at the university. They encouraged the cadets, as they called them at the library, to take a university degree. And I started off by doing science and became attracted to the experimental side, physics in particular, through biochemistry. I did better in chemistry than I did in physics. But Professor Brasfield Robertson was anxious to discover whether animals used any of the nitrogen in the air directly or not. He asked me to cooperate with him, and I did so, and put together an equipment to keep where the nitrogen of the air was replaced with argon, a rare gas, quite inert so it didn't hurt the animals. The idea was to keep several generations of mice in this atmosphere and see how they got on. Well, the fun of building this equipment and of finding ways of keeping the constituents constant, of removing the moisture that was produced, of introducing the food without introducing oxygen, of circulating the atmosphere and measuring it all the time by heat conduction to see what the relative proportions of oxygen and argon were, and automatically opening and closing valves, so fascinated me that I decided that physics was my milieu.
Of course, the reputation you had immediately was as a tremendous practical builder of experiments, of instrumentation. Did you suddenly find that things formed in your hands and you had this facility?
Yes, that old Rogers, who had been brought from England by Sir William Bragg as his assistant, taught me how to do glass blowing. I enjoyed that very much. It was just at that time, fortunately, a Pyrex became available.
So it didn't blow up?
It didn't crack quite so easily as the glass I learnt on.
What was the influence of the Braggs then in Adelaide as an unlikely centre of great physics?
Yes, the major thing was his portrait hanging on the first year lab. And there was downstairs a room where he'd done his measurements with the slate top table and so on, which was turned into a spectroscopic lab. But there were still the batteries that he used, a large assemblage of tiny little storage batteries. were charged up and gave a total when they were all put in series of about 1,000 volts. This was used on his electroscopes and on his ionization chambers for the work that he did with alpha particles.
Were you not moving towards that area yourself, nuclear physics, at the time?
Well, yes, I got very interested in nuclear physics, but from the lectures on radioactivity that were given by the professor of chemistry, Dad Rennie, as he was called, a very good lecturer, rather dour Scotsman, but a chap who did get into my mind somehow or other the difference between atomic weight and atomic number. And this made me think about ways in which one could change atomic number without necessarily changing atomic weight. And I did a series of experiments trying to produce uranium X from uranium. First thing to do was to take some uranium salt and remove the radioactive product of the disintegration of uranium. And that can be done chemically quite simply. And then bombard the depleted uranium with electrons in a Coolidge X-ray tube I made up and see whether one couldn't put electrons into the nucleus, which would be the same thing, of course, as taking a positive particle out of the nucleus, thereby change it into uranium X. But I had no luck. And, of course, now one knows it was a silly experiment to do.
Why is that?
Because the energies were nothing like big enough, about 100,000 volts I had from an old X-ray coil, and electrons just don't have that effect.
What was the atmosphere then around you in Adelaide? I mean, did you realise that you were embarked on a great career? Did your family realise that at all?
No. My mother was a school teacher, and she was always encouraging in reading. She was a practical sort of person too, good at fancy work and made our clothes, so that there was a practical side of the family, but there was also interest for my father which were totally different. He was interested in literature, tried to get his sons, he only had sons, five boys, interested in good literature, which we found a bit trying at times, you know, learning the whole of the Lady of Shalott by heart in order to be able to repeat it to him, which he thought was a good way to introduce one to poetry, but it had the opposite effect, of course.
Did you find that actually this command of language, both the Latin and the Greek, and this literature, helped you with the expression of science?
Wonderfully helpful. But I've always been interested as a result of this in words. I never let a word go past me that I don't understand without getting out the Oxford Dictionary or something and trying to find out what its origins were.
I've really been a little frustrated, I must say, with a tendency these days to go in for sort of ticker box exams instead of actually writing your ideas down in the essay form as one had to in presumably your day as well. I don't mean just the sort of physics questions that you had to solve, but the expression of science and the principles. How do you feel about this?
Oh, I feel very strongly about that. I remember very well when I was professor of physics in Birmingham in England for 13 years, and there was a lecturer in the department named Dee, and he was a very articulate fellow, a very good teacher, but not a very ambitious physicist. But we were having a meeting one day, and I was complaining rather bitterly about the English used by students in answers to physics essays and so on. And he said, "But Professor, you don't realise that the only way to learn how to write is to write." He said, "These boys don't get enough written work." And I believe that that's so, that the only way to learn how to use the language is to use it. It's no good just using it as spoken words. Well, it must be written, because then you've got time to think about it. Ockerisms, I'm quite sure, arise from using only the spoken word.
May I go back to just before you left for England, and that is this encounter in Adelaide when the great Rutherford came here to give a lecture. Another person who'd left the southern hemisphere to go north to develop a splendid career. The legend has it that when you heard the lecture that you were quite transformed. Is this true?
Yes. He came up from Port Adelaide where the ship was tied up, gave this lecture to us just while the ship was in port, and I made up my mind that this was the chap I wanted to work with if it was at all possible. Mind you, Rutherford was not a good lecturer. He ummed and he erred and he hard and he hummed, and he stood back from the blackboard and looked at it for periods of time. But there was something about him that made you feel that he cared, that this subject of physics generally, of understanding nature, was something that really mattered to him. It was his life, and it was inspiring in that sense.
Now, I hope I am not tiring you too much. There's another theoretical point I would like to mention. So far, we've spoken of the origin of the gamma rays. But now the question is there any connection? Can we explain the complicated system of gamma rays given, say, by radium C? It consists of probably 50 or more gamma rays. What point of view can we take on that very difficult problem? The bother is that a nucleus, as you know, is a very small thing, and we know very little about it. And this is one of the methods by trying to find these relations that we can hope to find something about the nucleus. I had the opinion for a long time that if we knew more about the nucleus, we'd find it was a much simpler thing than we supposed. That these fundamental things, I think, have got to be fairly simple. But it's the non-fundamental things that are very complex, usually. We must look for simplicity in the system first. And if the simplicity, we can't find it, well, we've got to look at something more complex. I am always a believer in simplicity, being a simple person myself.
That was Lord Rutherford speaking at the University of Göttingen in 1931, a recording we found in New Zealand, where he came from. Rutherford affected the course of science as much as anyone this century, perhaps as much as Einstein. He split the atom, he demonstrated the shape of it with its nucleus and orbiting electrons. He won the Nobel Prize, for chemistry actually, and did the work that merited a few more prizes. He inspired the famous names in physics for two or three generations. But back to Mark Oliphant. How did he get to join the great man at Cambridge?
Well, I was lucky enough for the professor, Sir Kerr Grant, went on sabbatical leave for a year. And during that, the senior lecturer in the department, Dr. Roy Burden, was running the show, and he encouraged me to get a little bit of research done on surface tension of mercury. As a result of this, and submitting this to the commissioners in London, I was awarded an 1851 exhibition. And on top of that, the university gave me free passage to England, which the steamship companies provided to each university in Australia.
The 1851, Rutherford had got one of those too, hadn't he?
That's right. Yes. He started out with one of those. He got his by accident, because the chap who really won it from New Zealand pulled out at the last minute. This shows you how fortunate
goes. Yes, but yours was more straightforward.
Yeah, perfectly straightforward. But Rutherford, I found, of course, was one of the selectors.
And how were you received?
Oh, extraordinarily well. I had to wait a little while in the passage outside Rutherford's office. Cavendish Laboratory, when I got to it, was a real shock to me. It was such a decrepit old building with the wooden floors, dirty windows. The floors were scrubbed once a year in September when the lab was shut, and the windows were washed at the same time. That was all that was ever done, as far as I could see. But waiting in the passage outside Rutherford's office, I was joined by another Australian who had come from Melbourne. His name was Eddie, and he later became the first head of the Commonwealth X-ray Laboratory, or whatever it's called. But anyway, I was called in first. To find myself in a room that was absolutely chock-a-block with tobacco smoke. Rutherford was puffing away at a pipe. He received me, and his desk was the biggest mess. It's even a bigger mess than my desk usually is, piled with papers and everything else. He received me very kindly, and we discussed what I had been doing and what I might do in the lab, and I went off and started work that same day.
It's been written that you became almost a son to him.
Rutherford, for some reason or other, and Lady Rutherford, were very kind to me and to my wife. We went on holidays with the Rutherfords. Rutherfords had a cottage in North Wales where we spent many very enjoyable holidays, and later on they had another cottage because that was a bit hard going for Rutherford, who found the walking in the hilly country a bit difficult. They moved down to Wiltshire and built a holiday cottage there, which we also enjoyed very much. Rutherford was a great one with the cross-cut saw, chopping up wood, sawing it up. And you had to take one end of the saw and he took the other, and we sawed up the wood for the fires, which were rather out of the ordinary in England to have a blazing log fire.
Slightly worrying, though, with the saw, he's, despite being a great experimentalist, a clumsy man, and it's said that you had to take over a lot of the glass-building, instrument-building for him.
Oh, yes, he was not good with his hands. He was rather shaky.
Hmm.
And if he suddenly came and saw what one was doing, got a bit impatient, said, "Here, let me do that," like putting a leaf on an electroscope, he invariably made a mess of it, and in the end one had to go back again.
But isn't it odd that he could design such beautiful experiments, such simple ones, and yet be cack-handed?
That's right. It was a surprising thing in him. But he also was so impatient. For instance, if we were taking a photographic record on bromide paper, we did long strips of bromide paper that rolled like film through a machine and traced the record of particles we were counting from a radioactive transformation. He would never be content to have it developed and then fixed in a fixer and then dried before one did anything with it. He'd insist it to be dragged out of the fixer after a few moments, and then he'd lean over it, looking at this record, dripping ash from his pipe all the time over one's precious record. And he always carried a stump of pencil in his waistcoat pocket. In those were days, of course, men always wore waistcoats. And he kept always a short piece of. He cut the pencil deliberately up into bits about an inch and a half or less long, and wrote with those. He'd pull this stump of pencil out of his pocket and start trying to mark on the wet bromide paper, which of course didn't do it any good. At the same time, you could never sort of feel angry with him or upset with him because he so radiated excitement about it.
Now imagine you have your nucleus here. There's your barriers that we're now so accustomed to. There's the normal level. We'll descend on it. You can't know anything really about that nucleus. We know it's got about 50 alpha particles, a whole lot of electrons, and an odd proton or two. Theoretically, impossible to tackle, except in broad lines, but one can look at it with the eye of imagination. Now, here is the point. You can imagine that this system is excited by the expulsion of a beta particle. And by the way, as I mentioned before, the beta particle seems to have an extraordinary power of exciting the resulting atom. It's remarkable. The mere expulsion of an electron doesn't seem to count very little. Should set the nucleus vibrating like a piano when you tumble it downstairs. And you could, one system, if you might imagine, the alpha particle goes up into a whole number of levels, unknown levels. And you'd have a new level for every gamma ray, practically. Well, that doesn't help much. You're really inventing levels.
I must ask you about a couple of things that puzzled me about the man, and who better than yourself to explain. There was a suggestion that he seemed to be in a kind of old-fashioned experimentalist mode, such that the new physics, when it broke, you know, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, was alien to this kind of Anglo-Saxon scientist. Now, that's not true, is it?
That's absolutely untrue. He delighted in pulling the legs of the theoretical physicist. I remember him telling Bohr on one occasion, when Bohr gave a talk, that the conclusions he drew from his theory was as uncertain as the premises upon which it was built. And when Heisenberg came and talked about the uncertainty principle, he did these things deliberately. He said these sort of things to people in order to bring out their real reasons for doing things, and yet he himself was very reluctant to give real reasons for any ideas he had. There's the story that I often told about him ringing me up in the middle of the night, or 3 in the morning it was, after we'd been puzzling over some experiments and not finding an answer to them, and he apologised when I went to the telephone for ringing at that time, said he'd been doing a bit of calculating on the results we'd got, and he said, "I think I know what those little short-range particles are." I said, "Well, what are they, Professor?" He said, "Well, they're helium atoms of mass 3. And I said, "But, Professor, what are your reasons?" I said, "Nothing on Earth can make 2 plus 2. We were hitting particles of mass 2, heavy hydrogen with particles of mass 2. I said, "Nothing on Earth can make 2 plus 2 equal 3. He said, "Reasons, reasons, Mark," he said, "I fill it in my water." And this was the sort of remark that he would make, you see. He was interested in everybody and what everybody was doing in the lab. He wasn't confined to radioactivity at all. He was just as interested in Kapitza's work on high magnetic fields and low temperatures. He was just as interested in Radcliffe and Appleton's work on the upper atmosphere, which, of course, was the beginning of radar, really.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was also that famous statement about the worth of splitting the atom and nuclear physics in general, that anyone who thinks that this work is going to produce anything of value is talking moonshine. Now, again, it seemed to me sticking the tongue in cheek, and later, I believe, he was perfectly clear that there would be value from this sort of work, I mean, practical spin-off.
Well, it wasn't so much that he disliked his experimental results being used for practical purposes. When we first did the experiments with heavy hydrogen and got the heavy hydrogen reactions sorted out a bit, I thought to myself, well, they go at such a low energy that it's worth trying to fire some heavy hydrogen ions into heavy hydrogen gas, get them totally absorbed in the gas instead of having a solid target behind it, and see whether we can't get more energy out of the system than we put into it. That's to say, you know, a little bit of atomic energy. And he was very angry with me for doing this experiment, which I'd done surreptitiously while he was on a trip to South Africa.
Angry because he thought you were wasting your time, or because he didn't think that sort of applied work was appropriate?
The latter, I think. I think he didn't like his ivory tower to be connected with very practical things for some reason or other. But, you know, one's got to remember that I think there was a certain amount of fear in his mind. Because in 1916, in the middle of the First World War, he gave a lecture in London on radioactivity. And he pointed out that there existed in the world scientists who wanted to bring about radioactive changes involving these very high energies at will. And he went on to say, "I hope that this will not happen during my lifetime, because some silly fool might find the answer and they'll blow the whole world to pieces." This was in 1916.
Incredible. One of the very few who could foresee that, I suppose.
That's right. So that I think at the back of his mind was the feeling that these energies that were involved in radioactive transformations were dangerous.
Going back to the time when, in fact, you were very closely involved in the realisation of this tremendous power with Bohr and others, what, in fact, was your role of being a kind of emissary from Britain to the United States to try to convince the President that there was something really important to consider?
Well, I never met the President. I was too lowly a person for that. I went to America in 1941, on radar business. You remember there had been developed in my laboratory by Randall and Boot cavity magnetron, which made microwave radar possible. And this, I went to America in connection with the early days of this. But I was given another little job to do. That's to say that we had been thinking a great deal about this problem of nuclear energy in England. Committee had been formed, gone into the question rather carefully. And in Birmingham, my colleague as Professor of Theoretical Physics was Rudolf Piles. And Otto Frisch had come from Copenhagen, where he'd been working with Lise Meitner, his aunt, and where they'd discovered the enormous energy that was set free in the fission process. he and Powell's being not allowed to have anything to do with such secret work as radar because they were alien subjects, set their minds to working out some of the problems of nuclear fission, how one might produce a chain process using the neutrons, which had been shown by Joliot-Curie to be emitted in the process. And they came to the conclusion and wrote a paper that if you could separate uranium-235, which was the one that went most easily with fast neutrons, the neutrons that were actually set free in the fission process, that one could produce a weapon of enormous power. And I was excited by this, and I took this to the committee which had been set up, the Maud Committee, as it was called.
Named after Bohr's nanny, or...
That's right. And we sent a copy of this report to the United States because we knew that they had a committee that was also thinking about these problems, although there was no real work going on in England at that time. But then we began to be really excited about it and think very seriously whether we shouldn't do some work on the separation of isotopes. I went off in 1941, as I said, to the United States to discover that the members of the committee which had been set up there had never seen this paper. So I went to see Lyman Briggs, who was the director of the National Physical Laboratory, and discovered that he'd put this report in his safe because he thought it was too secret to circulate. And I went after that, being unhappy about that, to see Bush and Conant, who were the two major people in contact with the president, on matters which were technologically important for the war, which they were quite convinced they had to come into sooner or later. Of course, this was before America was officially in the war. Having no luck with Bush and Conant, they were not interested. They said, oh, that's for the next war, not for this one.
Really?
Yes. I went to see Ernest Lawrence, with whom I'd spent a year in 1938 learning how to make cyclotrons in Berkeley in California. And Ernest was a member of the committee. And Ernest took this up like anything. He's a very vigorous person, you see. Before you could say Jack Robinson, he moved the committee and then Bush and Conant and finally the president to set up the Manhattan District.
And were you involved directly in the Manhattan Project?
Oh, yes. See, when we discovered that in Britain, to build a diffusion plant, say, to separate the isotopes of uranium, or I'd been fiddling around with the cyclotron magnet, which we'd built in Birmingham, to see whether we couldn't separate them electromagnetically. Lawrence had been doing this in Berkeley. But when we discovered that the industry in Britain was so occupied with making aircraft for these enormous raids that they were putting over Germany at that time, and Beaverbrook was so influential as the head of the aircraft production facilities in England, that he was able to grab practically everything and we couldn't get any help at all. It became apparent that it was impossible to do it in Great Britain. And so, after a bit of negotiation by Sir James Chadwick and me, we went to America and had discussion with their committee, which included Oppenheimer and Lawrence and Compton and people of that sort, and persuaded them that we could be of help to them. We came back to England and got together a team of people and moved across.
And what do those times look like from this vantage?
They were exciting times, you know. One was working against the clock, the British intelligence evidence, and British intelligence at that time was much better than the American, was that the Germans were well on the way. Turned out afterwards, of course, they'd taken the wrong track. They worked with slow neutrons instead of fast neutrons. But whether this was a deliberate action on the part of Heisenberg, who must have been aware of the possibility of a fast neutron reaction, I don't know. But perhaps he was given this job and maybe he took this course because he didn't like the idea of the big weapon.
Really, he was supposed to be a bit of a nationalist at times.
He was. He stayed in Germany, but I saw quite a bit of Heisenberg immediately before the war at Bohr's conferences in Copenhagen. And he was quite critical of the German
He was.
Regime. Yeah. He was by no means a complete follower. He, like most of us, I suppose, felt my country right or wrong. And those feelings of loyalty that come over people can, in the end, of course, override any sort of morality.
The subject of this week's Science Show, Sir Mark Oliphant. After the war, Sir Mark came back to Australia. It was a surprising thing for someone in his position to do, perhaps, being in the centre of international physics. Some say he forsook a Nobel Prize and maybe a more spectacular development to his career by returning here to Canberra, to what's been called a hole in the ground and lots of promises. That's what the start of the Australian National University was like. So how did it happen? Sir Mark.
I was visited in Birmingham by Coombs, Nugget Coombs, who at that time was the presiding influence over the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, which had generated the idea of a national university in Canberra. And he came to see whether I would be interested in this or not. I said I was quite prepared to consider it. And then there was set up a committee which consisted of Sir Howard Florey and Sir Keith Hancock and me. We met usually in Oxford, sometimes in London, to look at this problem and see what it was possible to do in Canberra and what our aims ought to be. We planned the place as a postgraduate university. It went on from there.
The three men, Sir Keith Hancock, Sir Howard Florey and Sir Mark, then flew out to Australia, accompanied by their wives. It was 1946, and such a trip was quite different from today's jet travel.
That was quite an adventure because one had to fly out in a converted Lancastrian bomber, which was run by Imperial Airways as far as Karachi and then changed over to either the same or a similar aircraft. One couldn't tell the difference, run by Qantas.
How long did it take from London?
2.5 days.
Must have been awful.
No, it was very interesting and memorable trip, both for me and for my wife. We enjoyed it. The aircraft, of course, flew at low altitude, 7,000 or 8,000 feet most of the time, so one had a marvellous view off the countryside. The other nice thing about it was that there were bunks in the aircraft, you see. It only carried 6 passengers. You sat on one side of the aircraft and you could put your feet against the other side of the aircraft. There was one steward on board to look after you.
Must have been a bit bumpy too, wasn't it?
And I don't remember it being very bumpy at any time. The weather was good. It was autumnish time out here.
How did you come actually to join the ANU and set up physics experiments with the cyclotron?
Oh, there was a lot of heartburning about that. I had, of course, to persuade some people in England to come out with me. One couldn't come out alone. You had to have at any rate, a small team. I got two or three Australians who'd been working in England with me or elsewhere to come out. I was also lucky enough to be able to get a young mechanic named Edwards, Jimmy Edwards, who'd been in Cambridge in the Cavendish lab and had moved with me to Birmingham. He came out, and also the chap whom I'd made the head technician in Birmingham.
You also brought Sir Ernest Titterton with you, didn't you?
That was later. I had had some talks with him, but he didn't come out with me. But I had quite a bit of correspondence with him after I got here, and then he came quite soon after I did.
He was involved in a direct way with the Maralinga tests and so forth for the British. Were you involved at all?
No. See, after the successful burst in the desert in New Mexico and then followed so quickly by the devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I felt so utterly disgusted and upset by this use of the nuclear weapons against the civilian population, which I'd had long talks in America with Bohr about the moral and ethical problems associated with this. I felt just like he did about it. that I decided that I was going to have nothing more whatsoever to do with nuclear weapons, and I haven't from that day to this.
Bit of a paradox recently to have been named a security risk. Was it for that reason?
No, I don't know what the reason that the British felt that was, but I know why I was refused a visa to the United States in 1951. I found that out because I just pestered the American embassy until I got them to get the information. And they said that they did not accuse Professor Oliphant of being a communist or a fellow traveller. But this, of course, was in the McCarthy era. But Professor Oliphant made statements about the use of the nuclear bomb that provided the Soviets with bullets to fire at the United States. This was the reason given. And by the way, the embassy and the United States government vigorously denied that they'd ever denied me a passport, that it was just late in coming.
Amazing. But when did you get the information as to the reason that they decided to withhold?
When it was too late to go to the conference, of course.
I see. Do you think you've ever suffered from being outspoken, from being direct?
That's the only time that I really had any real difficulty as a result of it. Otherwise, I don't think I've had any problems.
Most scientists aren't forthright. Most scientists tend to be rather more uncertain, I suppose, about the ideas that they're presenting and couch it much more in a mealy-mouthed way. Is it that you've thought these things through and know what you think?
Well, I've already told you about my youth and upbringing as what the Americans would call a do-gooder. I don't think I've ever lost it. I caught it from my parents. And I was so upset by the use of the nuclear weapons that I spent an awful lot of time, much more time than I should have in England, going round and talking about these weapons and what they meant for the future of the world. And I think this perhaps was one of the reasons why I was regarded as a security risk, because I was against nuclear weapons, which Britain had decided to make. And Chadwick had sent me back, of course, before he came back to find a suitable spot for a research establishment to do nuclear energy research in England. He was very, very keen on Britain having the bomb. He said somebody else has got to have it except these Americans. He didn't like the Americans. Although he got on so extraordinarily well with General Groves, and General Groves trusted him, and so did General Marshall. He was the leader of the British delegation. I was his second in command, as it were.
What do you think of the scale of things now, where we're talking about over, what, 2 or 3 years or more, $23 billion American dollars to be spent on Star Wars and this colossal investment in nuclear weapons systems?
I think it's utter balderdash. For one thing, as has been pointed out so many times by you and by other people, there are enough bombs in this world now to smash everything up many times over. So why make more bombs? There's no reason whatever, or better bombs, those that we've got are perfectly all right, to do this horrible job if one wants to. But the real trouble about Star Wars is that this is an attempt to make nuclear weapons respectable. Let the other chap have nuclear weapons if he wants to, or you yourself to possess them. But they're not going to be effective weapons because there is a defense against them. Now, this is pie in the sky. There is no known way in which one could do this. And everybody who's thought about the problem agrees with this. They talk about using lasers, for instance, to knock the weapons out. Well, now, a laser beam's got to be pointed so accurately in order to have a concentrated enough beam of energy that it just becomes impossible, moving at an enormous speed. And the same with very fast particles that will travel for long distances through the upper atmosphere in order to intercept. So they've got to be directed with such accuracy that it becomes a practically impossible task. Apart from that, the mere generation of the laser beam, say an X-ray laser beam, or a beam of particles involves carrying up into space a whole enormous laboratory of stuff which weighs so much that to have many of these centres up there would not only cost the Earth, but it becomes just ridiculous.
There is a great worry, of course, that, for instance, British science is being crippled by this kind of investment. Over 50% of the research investment in Britain is now, for the first time, towards military research. And, of course, it's well over that in the United States. One worries about the future of science. So even though various people might say, look, we're just doing metals work and we're just doing fuel research, we're not really doing military work. The kind of juggernaut effect is somewhat awesome, isn't it?
I agree with you entirely. I can't understand the mentality that uses knowledge in general in this way, deliberately prostituting it for this purpose of killing people. After all, it's a killing business. And life is a precious commodity. I feel very moved always when I read again the Russell Einstein Manifesto, which ends up with the words, "Remember your humanity and forget the rest." It's because they were talking, they said, as human beings to human beings. And I believe that to use knowledge of any kind, whether it's physical or any other sort of knowledge, in order to kill people, is a horrible thing to do, and I don't want to have any part in it, nor do I want other people to have any part in it. Not that I want to compel people to do anything, but I can't understand people going in and giving themselves over to this work. But they do, you see. Doctors are quite willing to work on biological weapons, although their Hippocratic Oath makes them minister the healing art, not the killing art.
Was it different in the days when you went across to the Manhattan Project?
Well, then, of course, there was this terrific challenge, you see, of the fact that the Germans were working on me. At no cost must they be able to get there first. This was the feeling of everybody. Towards the end, a lot of us began to have scruples and hoped that the darn thing wouldn't work.
Yes, so you're saying that this generation should have learnt from yours by now?
Yes, it should have learnt.
That interview with Sir Mark Oliphant was recorded in Adelaide in 1985. The recordings of Lord Rutherford were made in 1931 in Göttingen. I found them in Radio New Zealand in Christchurch. The music, which reminds me so much of Sir Mark's combination of steel and gentleness, is Dvorak's Quartet No. 12, The American. The Science Show is produced by Polly Rickard and Janita Palmer. I'm Robin Williams.
Seventy years exactly since Mark Oliphant became the first president of the Australian Academy of Science. A man who, as you heard, worked with some of the greatest names in history, from Lisa Meitner and Robert Oppenheimer to Nugget Coombs and Howard Florey, from a hole in the ground to the ANU, from the Manhattan Project to Project for Peace. One of my top 100 Australian scientists, of course.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.